welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I talk with John Clark about his residential architecture firm on the East Coast. His firm provides classic custom design services with a modern twist called Red Jay Architecture, much like renaming a classic cardinal after its backyard cousin, the Blue Jay, but just red because it's red. He shares how to keep it real in the way he serves his clients. His practice is an extension of his own interests, which enables him to solve the unique challenges people encounter in their homes. He lives his life, and he meets people naturally through his own interests and through his kids' activities, and just because he loves meeting and talking with people. And these conversations create an authentic connection, and that becomes the groundwork for the relationship that's needed to design a custom home. And so these natural relationships and living his life in that backyard, he's able to build connections and referral networks to run his Red Jay practice. John, welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I'm so glad we get to talk today about what you're doing with your practice on the East Coast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm excited to engage.
Awesome. Well, why don't you start off telling us a little bit about yourself and your firm?
Yeah. My name is John Clark. I have a solo practitioner residential architecture firm in Silver Spring, Maryland. Had the firm for almost 4 years now at this point. It's just me.
Congrats. And so the name of your firm is?
Red Jay Architecture. I know you have an affinity for birds, and I have a bird named firm. So
nice. I haven't heard of a red jay. Oh, like a jay, a blue jay, but it's red.
Yeah. It's probably not a real bird, but the story goes, my son was two. There was a pair of blue jays that lived in the backyard of our house, and we used to watch them fly around and wrestle. We assumed they were brothers. They did a lot of wrestling and attacking each other. And one day a cardinal landed in the backyard, and being a two-year-old, my son used the words in his vocabulary to describe what he saw. And he said, "Dad, it's a red jay." And I thought that was great deductive reasoning from a two-year-old. So I filed it away, and 10 years later, used it as a firm name. So
I love that. How do you think that represents the work you do?
I've always gravitated towards, you know, single family and sort of being able to be a base level conversation with people. And I like being a trusted resource. So I think that sort of dovetails in with the name of the firm. No bird joke intended. I think there's, you know, you can keep a levity to this. And it helps people sort of stay calm in what could be a traditionally stressful practice.
That is such a great grounding story to kind of emphasize those family values as you're going into residential projects. Do you always work with residential, or do you find yourself doing other projects as well?
You know, it's my ideal goal clients, I guess, say are a two-income family, both people work, kids, busy lives, lots going on. And I can relate to that based on my own life and my own experiences. So there's some of that as well. But I enjoy engaging and finding out what people do and how they live. And by nature, a lot of people tend to become friends after they become clients, which is really nice. So
that really adds to the value of the relationship you're building with your clients, because the design profession can be so personal, especially when you're designing a home and going through that process with someone.
Right.
They definitely benefit from trusting the designer they're working with, because things aren't always easy along the path. And it's not just the design that has hurdles. It's also the construction and zoning and everything else that can come up.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, John, there's a lot of residential firms. So are there any parameters you put around yourself to say, yes, that's the right kind of project for me? Or do you just go, yeah, the sky's the limit. I just do it all.
I'd love to say the sky's the limit. I think there are some natural boundaries, if you will. I always start with a phone call. You know, usually there's an email connect and, hey, let's get together and talk. And I used to go on an immediate appointment and meet them at their house. And sometimes you get into those meetings and realize you might not be a good fit for them, for their needs. They might not be at a point where they're ready to hire an architect yet. or they might not need an architect. So you can vet a lot of that on a telephone call and sort of figure out if how they need you, if they need you, et cetera. I will do anything from tiny little addition renovation projects to brand new single family homes construction. I am a big believer in being available in terms of visiting the site regularly. So that causes some geographical issues sometimes. And for the right project, I'll travel. I have a project in Maine right now, and it requires to travel, and I will absolutely go up there anytime I need to go up there if the client is cool with it. But for the most part, it's DC, Maryland, and Virginia tends to be my geographical area. So
that is nice. The climate is similar. The detailing of some of the wall sections is probably similar.
Yeah,
that can help.
Yeah, same climate zone. The challenge is that it's different, so many different jurisdictions all within sort of a 50-mile radius. So
that's a lot to navigate.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because that component can be so restrictive to the height of the building, the permissible materials, and just all the things that can be thrown at you. Like, building code is relatively the same per state.
Yeah.
But every city, every jurisdiction can play with the design aesthetics.
Yes.
And I've seen some that really get restrictive. So how do you navigate that?
I remember I had a professor in college, and he said, you know, you're never going to be expected to memorize the building code. So you need to just know where to find things and or when to call a consultant, which I always have always sort of taken that to heart and remembered that as a fallback. Unfortunately, the reality is you can't tell clients that. You're their trusted advisor. So you need to know at least how to get them the answers and provide drawings that are going to get a permit, right? That's the goal here. So it is challenging because there are, you know, multiple jurisdictions. There's four or five counties I regularly work in, including DC. They're all on different codes. They're all IRC, but one's 16, one's 18, one's 21, one's about to adopt 21. And then they'll have their own local amendments. So I try to get to know somebody at the local zoning office, someone that you can, you know, has been there a while. And it takes a minute to figure that out. But someone you can call and say, hey, I'm working on this project. Haven't done this sort of thing before. Where do I start? And the people at the local jurisdictions tend to be very helpful for the most part. If they know that you're a part of the community, you're trying to do the right thing, and you're trying to you know, do it in the right order. I think you can't just call and be like, I need a permit tomorrow. That's not going to get you where you need to go. So knowing who to call, when to call, I think that's much more important than necessarily knowing what's, you know, the exact verbiage in section R310 for emergency egress.
But it sounds like you try to be proactive in being informed before it influences the decisions that you present to your clients.
Exactly. It's, you know, being that advisor, that trusted advisor, you need to know going into your schematic design that this is going to fall within the parameters of the requirements. The worst thing you can do is show a client something shiny and beautiful that they want, and then they find out that they can't have it. So making sure that as much as you can, that doesn't happen, and also preparing them that may happen for reasons outside of your control.
So how do you get new clients? Is it all referrals? Or do you get leads through your website? And in the last 4 years, have you seen a steady flow the whole time, or do you see it ebb and flow?
I think I've started to feel it a little more in the last year. I was very fortunate that I started my firm sort of, I would say, on the back of my previous employer who was retiring. So there was sort of a nice little off ramp there in terms of work that we had under contract that we were able to finish there. And then direct referrals from my previous firm, you know, people were still calling them and saying, hey, are you doing this? And, you know, call John. And that was a really nice, an amazing way to have a firm start. So I've been lax, if you will, in terms of marketing. And, you know, I have a website that is a work in progress. I think it's more to show proof of life that I am a real architect, with a real company. And it's, you know how it is as well. Photography is challenging. Some folks, you get to the end of a job and you're very proud of it, and they don't want you to take photos of their house, which, or at least not to show publicly, which I understand. Photography is expensive, and there's the time element. I'd love to take pictures of everything, but, you know, staging a project cleaning it up, having the photos taken and processed, and then putting on a website time too. So that is certainly on my list of goals to get better about. But to answer your overall question, yeah, it's mostly word of mouth. And I find that it's an advantage to me because it's coming from contractors or clients that I've worked with before. And so it provides a bit of a pre-vetting for the client in terms of they've probably chatted with them about what this process can be like. It can be expensive. It's stressful. It's a lot of decisions to make. So by the time they get to me, many times they know what's coming. At least they think they know what's coming, and they have a pretty good eye on the ball. And then I just sort of, you know, take it from there, get a comfort level, and figure out how I can help.
That's fun. So I did just want to pull up your website to see, and I love seeing that hand sketch of an elevation. That is beautiful and very, very nice hand.
I still like the sketch. Yeah.
So on your website, it looks like you're actually appealing to a specific region.
Yep.
So if you're catering to that environment, then you're kind of fitting into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Category.
Yeah,
I do see some really nice details that are very attractive in your work, and they're modern, they're lively, and the detailing on the interior, like your windows and the materials you're using, there's a very nice appeal for someone who has an eye for looking for that clean design look. You're definitely showing that on your website.
Well, I think given the market that I'm in, there are so many homes that were all built sort of just pre or just post World War II. So there is a lot of brick colonials. There is a couple farmhouses that were the original houses in DC. You get the big corner lots, and those are the fun projects to work on. But it is amazing how DC actually has a great, resource on the surveyor's website. And in terms of historical documents available for almost every property in the city has some record of an original wall check or a survey. And it's nice to be able to get some history on a property before you go into it. But the reality is I've been fortunate to go into so many of these houses at this point that I know exactly what's happening in the walls for the most part. Occasionally you'll get, you know, a renovation that happened in the 1950s or 60s and you're sort of scratching your heads about what changed. But for the most part, having a familiarity with these older homes, living in one myself, knowing the pitfalls and sort of how to tweak little things that can mean a big difference in terms of quality of life. That I enjoy. I would say that it doesn't really answer the question about my sense of style, but I would say I have a sense of proportion, I guess, versus a sense of style in terms of, you know, space planning, in terms of what's appropriate for window sizes and things like that in the spaces. And that I think goes most of the way to my style. My style is good space planning.
Well, it's cool to hear the response to historic and the new and having the same mentality about both, but also having a fresh look. Like modern living is different than those old farmhouses and integrating the architecture into that.
Sure.
I really think your firm name is your bird. And the reason I say that is that a cardinal, a red jay, is very classic.
Yes.
It's iconic. And it's a quieter bird than an actual blue jay. And a cardinal is very family oriented, very much connected to its mate.
Yeah.
The cardinal lives by a very specific pattern. Like when we've had cardinals in our backyards, they come regularly every day at the same time, the two of them together. Like they build that pattern, and those backyard birds really build their network based on referrals. And that's like neighbors telling neighbors, hey, I've got this cardinal, you should check it out. And so I put out this feed and the next neighbor does the same thing and gets to enjoy the cardinal as well. It builds a natural network and people share this love of songbirds, just like people share their love of design or their home remodel. But by not just being a cardinal, but being a red jay, that puts a modern spin on it. And I don't think you're as loud as a blue jay. Blue jays can be quite squawky. They make the hawk sound that we think eagles make. So I do think that cardinal is really appropriate, but saying red jay is that modern twist that really just aligns with that idea of whether it's new construction or historic homes that you're bringing up to a modern lifestyle.
Yes. Yeah.
It's just kind of that classic, genuine look at how people are living and meeting them where they're at. So I like it.
Right. Just sort of a traditionalist with an edge.
Yeah, it's a good edge. Like, it does have that defined shape. You know a cardinal by its silhouette. You wouldn't identify it as anything else.
Yep.
So we figured out your bird.
Yeah.
And we've talked about your ideal client. What are three words that you think summarize your practice?
Keep it real, right? Those would be my three. As a fan of 90s hip hop, it helps in many ways. I would say it fits with my personality style. I think the most important thing as an architect is to remember who you're working for and what you're doing at all times. And a lot of architects tend to get themselves into trouble by over designing or over promising or doing things that you might not even have been asked to do. So I do try to listen to my clients, and there's not a chance to innovate and to push things and to try, you know, with your design. But I think it really goes back to understanding the client, what they really want, what they're asking you to do, what their budget is, what the scope is. And then you say, you know, hey, if I was able to provide a improved design and it might raise the budget, would you be interested in seeing it? You know, kind of put it back and see, yeah, you know, we want to see it. But I'm not going to show them a design that's amazing that is not in their budget unless they ask me to. So it's sort of recognizing that and remembering who they are and what they asked you to do.
Personally, I struggle with that conversation because I'll work with homeowners and they just want to dream.
Yeah.
And I'll suspend reality and be like, yeah, we can dream. And I don't push back enough.
Right.
Because we get to the pricing phase and then they're so surprised, especially because of the last few years when construction costs for things have been out of this world. And I know because when I do work on my own house, I only understand the DIY rate, but the contractor rate is almost priced for a new home. And these projects are just a single room addition. And it's just been exorbitant over the last few years. So what are some things you're doing to manage that conversation? And as you say, keep it real.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm going to segue a bit here, but my spouse and my brother are both architects by trade as well. We all went to school together. We don't get out much. All of our friends are architects. And they both work in the commercial field. And so their clients are typically, at the end of the day, investors. And it's an impersonal way of handling finance that allows there to be a bit of a barrier between hurt feelings and reality. When you're working with the single family client, you know, the budget is tied into their personality and what they have and who they are. So it's a much more personal decision-making process, which means misses in the budget hurt a lot more. And it's a real challenge, I think, to get people comfortable with that. And so sort of the way I've addressed it is we talk about the budget at every single meeting. I give them a very broad range at the beginning and think of it as a funnel. We're trying to work down the funnel until we get to the bottom line. So there's a lot of budgeting happening. And usually it's a combination of unit pricing, square footage pricing, historical pricing. So if I've recently done a similar window package on another project and it's, you know, Pella or Windsor or Marvin, I have a pretty good idea of what that window package would cost for their home. So it's getting them in the ballpark and then having a contractor maybe provide a preliminary price. Sometimes we can get to the end schematic and with some notes and dimensions, we can kind of get within a 15 or 20% of what the real budget might be. And that kind of is a good budget check. People, you know, stay plugged in. They know where we're heading. And it eliminates or reduces the element of surprise because, you know, I think we've all been on projects where you get to the end and you get the budget and everyone freaks out. And sometimes the project just stops or doesn't happen. And that's the worst feeling for everyone. So sort of how do you mitigate that before you get there is the real challenge for all of us.
Yeah, and to clarify, for me, the last 5 years of practice, if I've done a residential project, it's always that schematic pricing set.
Yep.
I always make sure that we're talking to a contractor early so that we don't get to so far down the line into something that they can't afford.
Yeah.
And I also want to make sure that I've got plenty of design fee left for refining and getting us closer to those options. So often, it's been just so far out of the range, it stops the conversation. And that's been really hard.
Yeah. And that's a big part of that initial phone call. I think I chatted about sort of before I even go out there. It's, you know, I always end the conversation or get halfway into the conversation with what's your timeline and what's your budget. Right. And, I worked for a design build firm, before a few firms back, and you know, by nature, we had to ask those questions at every, and the architects would go on first appointments sometimes, and we'd be involved in the front end of the sales process. And that was very eye opening to me to, you know, well, we can talk about numbers with people. And they're like, yeah, why wouldn't you? And I had come from previous firms where that was verboten. And we just, you know, we don't want to scare them off. It's like, well, in retrospect, that was pretty silly. You know, if you're going to scare them off, do it at the very beginning before everyone's invested. you know, now I found that most people have an idea of, I use the car analogy. If you're car shopping, you're probably not going to the Ferrari dealership. If you know you're going to get a Toyota, you start at the Toyota dealership, right? So, it sort of people come in there and they all have a number in their head and they should be able to tell you that number. I understand not wanting to tell a contractor that number, but they have to be able to tell the designer that number so that you can sort of stay in those parameters. And once they reveal that number, if historically speaking, based on my experience, I think it's going to be twice as much. Sometimes that's the end of the conversation, or sometimes they call me back in 6 months and say, yeah, we talked to 3 other architects and 2 builders and they all said the same thing. So you never know when it's going to come back, but I'd rather have a hard, honest conversation up front, than, like you said, kind of get through schematic and get some scary numbers back.
So do you take every project, even the small ones, or do you just try to have enough projects to keep things moving?
I am very much a work-life balance person. I think I don't want to get into a philosophical discussion of architecture, but I guess that's why I'm here. So I'll do it. There are many people that I went to school with that ate, slept, lived, and breathed architecture. And it was their life outside of studio, outside of their job, in their job. It was an extension of who they are. And that's amazing. And that's not me. I love architecture and I love what I do. And occasionally I'll just go for a walk and take my sketchbook. And that part of me lives on, the perennial student. But I like doing many other things. And I'm fortunate that I can be a business person and do something that I love. But if I didn't love it, I'd still probably be a business person. The goal is to, you know, live a lifestyle that I have the freedom to live. My kids can play sports and go to school and, we can eat and occasionally maybe go on vacation. And that's a pretty good quality of life. So if I wasn't doing architecture, I would fill that void with something else. But I have my coals in many different fires outside of architecture as well, as I'm sure you do too. You know, you're an artist, you're an innovator, you're a podcaster, you're an architect, you're a mom. So you've got a lot of things going on. And I think that having that balance enables me to relate to my clients because they have many interests outside of their jobs. And not everyone gets to be in a profession where it's sort of an extension of your personality type, right? Like if you're an accountant, you might hate numbers, but you might be good at it. And so that's why you chose to go into that career. But
that is such a great point. And I actually, yeah, I have a million hobbies and my husband only cut me off at chickens.
For now.
I do ceramics. I've got painting. I've got woodworking. He lets me do it all. But when I wanted chickens, he's like, really? Having all those side interests, I don't know. I've had clients that value canning and vacuum sealing, and I understand how to do those. I understand how to can. Yeah. I know what ingredients you need, what kind of space you need in your kitchen, how hot the kitchen gets.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And I know the storage that you need that aligns and supports those hobbies like sewing, quilting. I understand how much extra space is needed mm-hmm. to be able to do the thing.
But then you also instantly bond. You bond with the client, and now you know there's a trust level there as well. You know, humans are such social creatures that when you can bond with somebody like that, well, all of a sudden you sort of five steps ahead in the getting to know you process. And now you're more of a, what else do we have in common? You know, what else can we talk about that we can relate and share interests? So that's an important part of the social culture of architecture and being a sort of an advocate there as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And I agree with you. I've known architects who just live and breathe it. And I call them hummingbirds. They're just operating at a different frequency than the rest of us. And they live off that sweet nectar of design. But they are, like I said, a different frequency. They're a different kind of bird and they're doing their thing. But the rest of us are just kind of good chilling and having a more holistic look at life. I'm curious what kind of boundaries you've set for yourself.
Yeah, I'm pretty good about, you know, when it's vacation time, it's vacation time. I always send emails out before I go on vacation. And I'm like, hey, I'm going to be out of town. I probably won't have phone access. You can email me. If it's an emergency, I'll try to get back to you. And I do check my phone regularly. I don't tell them that always. I don't take calls or meetings on weekends, obviously. My work-life balance, I don't wake up super early, but I get up, I have breakfast, get the kids out. And then it's sort of I work pretty hard until lunchtime in design stuff. And then sort of a hodgepodge of from noon until kids get home and it's sports, dinner, whatever's happening. And then I get some of my best work done, like after they go to bed from 8:30, 9 o'clock at night until about 11. 11's usually if I have to tap out there. So it's a long day, but I break it up into manageable chunks. My sort of construction management stuff, day-to-day stuff, operations all happens during the morning hours. And then my creative juices hit my brain around 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. And I get two really good hours of design thinking and I go to bed and sleeping on it helps me wake up and, you know, further that design. If I stop and I have a problem, usually by the morning, my brain will self-consciously have told me, hey, try this or do this. Or, I live with another architect. I can go to the office downstairs and say, can you look at this for 2 seconds? What would you do here? So maybe I did lie to myself a little bit when I said that, architecture does not permeate out of me in non-work hours too. It might a little bit. It is part of who I am. But yeah, I think I do make time for family stuff. My kids are young enough where I know this is not going to be, they're not going to want to hang out with me forever. And these are the peak years. So I'm trying to actively take advantage of that and be present for those things. And most of my clients have children the same age. I don't know if this is a new experience for me, but a lot of my clients are starting to be younger than me for the first time, which is interesting. I feel a little older. But most of them have children that are kind of in the same age and makes it one more thing we can bond over and establish trust over. So
that's really great. And it helps with that other component that seems to integrate itself with your firm, that personality component. As an architect, you're developing your skills in school. What do you think your unique skills are compared to your wife or your brother, the other people you know, the other architects you know? What kind of led you down this path to do residential as a sole practitioner?
All right. I am a walking contradiction. I was really into two-dimensional drawing, three-dimensional art, pottery, sculpture, things like that in high school. But I always knew I wanted to be an architect. It was always there. And so it wasn't a question for me. Everyone was sort of, what do I do? I mean, even remember freshman studio in architecture school. It was like a question of who was going to drop out when. And the teachers were like, look to your left, look to your right. Those people won't be here in 4 years. And it wasn't even a question. I was like, well, I am. And it wasn't a cocky thing. It was just, I was so sure this is what I wanted. So I think that sort of having an idea of what you want to do is a real luxury. I look back on it now and I was like, I was a idealistic kid who just happened to guess right. But I never thought I would do single family residential and I got my first job in it and found that I loved it. And I never thought I would get a license. And then my mom, of course, was like, well, you got a master's degree. Why'd you get a master's if you're not going to get a license? It's like, well, that's a great question, mom. So listen to your mom. So I got a license. And then I thought, well, I'm never going to own my own firm, which is why I thought it was silly to get a license, which is why I thought it was silly to get a master's. And here we are, 3.5 years in. So the big question now, are you going to hire someone? And I'm a hard no, which means it's probably going to happen in the next 5 years. But right now, I think the pace of the quality of life is aligns with my personality and my family goals. So for now, this is perfect.
And so what makes it so great to be a sole practitioner?
Being your own boss is sort of everything you hear, what you imagine it would be. At least it has been for me. And I've been fortunate. I've never been one of the architects who's worked like crazy hours. All the firms I've had reasonable time. Maybe it's because of single family residential, but it's always been reasonable. You know, it's 40 hours, sometimes occasional overtime. Sometimes you go to a site meeting on a Saturday. And I've sort of had 3 or 4 jobs in a row like that. And so I've kind of carried that into my own now. So it's time management is important. I am someone who really enjoys relaxing. So I need to, you know, I need to leverage that and work when I want to work and I'm into it. And when I relax and I chill pretty hard. And that's important too, because it allows me to recharge. And I don't mean sitting on the couch or watching TV. Sometimes I read, but I love to be outside riding mountain bikes. I used to be more competitive when I was younger and faster, but now it's, I jog instead of race and run. I lackadaisically, hike instead of ultra trail running, but I'd love to get back to that if I had a little. So,
well, with your beard and the flannel shirt, you know, you look a bit like a mountaineer. I love it. That's great.
Yeah, I'm an urban mountaineer. That's I fit all the stereotypes. So.
Well, John, is there anything else we haven't touched on that you would like to chat about?
One of the things I've really enjoyed about this, I miss the social component. I think a lot in terms of when I first left working for firms. I love to talk. That's why I'm here. But I miss that that engagement and the social aspect of being in an office. And ironically, I started my firm after COVID, so I was used to the solidarity at that point, or being a solo. But I have a group of other solos that I know, you being one, obviously. But it is really nice to talk to other people who are going through the same thing. And even if you're not necessarily sharing a desk or sharing an office space, having that network of consultants, I have some engineers that I just had lunch with an engineer today. And it was sort of, we work together a lot, but catching up and not talking about work for an hour and then maybe peppering in a few things at the end. It's like, hey, I've got a proposal coming your way. Can you get out to this job site and take a look? But for the most part, how's your family? Oh, where are you going on vacation? You know, what are you doing outside of this? And it goes back to, I like to talk to people and I like to listen to people and get a sense of who they are and what they're interested in. And that helps me to define them. And also myself, you know, I like to hear how people do things. And for instance, this is my first podcast. Never thought I would do a podcast, and here we are. So who knows? Maybe I'll start a podcast.
That'd be great. And so going back to what you just mentioned, having lunch with an engineer, that is a great way to get work. You're building your professional network and you started at a design build firm. And so you've got some networks with people who build or are contractors. And so what is that side of your business like? Or if you're mountain biking or hiking, doing these other things or at your kid's school, is that an avenue where you're meeting people who need your services?
Exactly. And it's, I don't approach those as everyone's a mark, right? It's not the way my brain works. But people find out, you know, I have a friend who's an attorney and he was one of the first people I knew to get to pass the bar. And he was the person that everybody called when they got arrested or did something dumb. And he's like, guys, I'm a tax accountant, like lawyer. I can't help you if you got arrested for punching somebody at a bar. That's not me. So there is an interest there. I think people hear architect and it's like, oh, well, you know, I just put some new tile in my kitchen. And I'm like, cool. Tell me more. Tell me about it. And you just listen. I like to listen and sort of see where the conversation goes. But I've absolutely gotten clients from, you know, school pickup line. I've gotten clients from referral. Repeat is hard in our business because it's single family and sort of usually it's a one and done thing. But occasionally you'll get someone that has a beach house or has a cousin or so those are always interesting and I like to be a part of it. you get the clients sometimes from contractors, obviously. That's a big one. I think we had chatted about sort of at the end of the year there, I just placed a few phone calls to builders I hadn't worked with in a while just to check in and say, you know, Happy New Year. Hope you're doing well. And like a week later, I was going on all these first appointments because they're like, oh, I forgot about you, or I didn't know you were doing this kind of work. So that was eye-opening in terms of, whoa, there is a lot of work out there. And I try to do the same. I think, I know a network of engineers and architects, and we all sort of refer each other. If, for instance, I get a multifamily inquiry, and that's not something I typically do, I've got people to call, though, and people to refer. Hey, this person would be great. They're in your market and they're very familiar with this, or they know the rules for low-income housing and they can help you as a consultant. Or I've worked with several great structural engineers, a great mechanical engineer, and those folks are jacks of all trades. And when my structural engineer is not working on single family things, he's at amusement parks surveying roller coaster tracks and rides. And so that's sort of that's his main hustle, and residential sort of keeps his toe in the industry. So it's amazing what everyone is sort of a jack of all trades and what they're doing out there, but it's fun to ask.
So this really emphasizes your red J image, because people don't always think of Cardinals, but when they see it, they remember it. And so it's about staying visible, staying top of people's mind. And it doesn't have to be heavy. It can be a light touch. It can just be that flash of red, but it'll stick in your brain when you think about it. So there's a call that you don't just hunker down and hide.
No.
You've got to keep active, and it aligns. It does sound like it aligns well with your interests and how you like to live your life. You enjoy having those lunches and that informal outreach that you do, whether it's annually or biannually, just by being present. And when work comes up, you're the one they think of.
Yeah, exactly. And to your point, you know, it is sort of your brain is geared to remember the last few things that happened. So, you know, the further you get out of someone's mind, and it's the same with decision making on a project. It's sort of, we've all got clients who sort of languish in the decision making, and it's our job to sort of check in. It's, hey, you have any questions? What can I do to help? And if you don't check in, sometimes the job just goes forever. So that is a responsibility for a designer, but also as humans, you know, like check in on your fellow humans. You know, it's a tough political climate for a lot of people right now. And I think that without getting too far into that, you know, maybe look locally, look at your neighbors. What can you do? Or just check in on people, be a good human. And a lot of that goes to being a good designer is having empathy, being able to listen. And if you can help someone, great. And if you can, it's okay to tell them that, but you can certainly try, you know?
I do believe that's the superpower of designers. It's being able to put ourselves in other people's shoes and just imagine, because our imaginations are so big, we can manage that. And when you're good at asking questions and listening to that response, people open up.
Yeah.
And you can really be a thoughtful designer for them and help solve their underlying problems, not just what they're asking for.
Exactly.
But really find what's bothering them about their house, or what kind of really instigated them to seek out a solution from an architect.
Sometimes finding and solving those small problems is more gratifying and leads to solving the bigger problems, right? I've had many clients come to me because they hate where the refrigerator is in their kitchen. And then it turns into a whole project, right? Or you go to the car dealership to get your wiper blades changed on your car, and you leave with a new car. So you never know what the opportunity is going to be until you ask questions and sort of find out what the real problem is. We've chatted before, but I can't help a client unless they've got a real problem. And so if you can't identify that, then you can't help them. So you have to do that. You have to bring that out of people. And a lot of times people know what it is right off the bat, but you get some folks that have a lot of tiny little issues with their house and they can't place why they don't like it. And, you know, so, well, have you thought about this? And then it just sort of shifts the perspective and how people think. And, you know, all of a sudden the project is real again. So
I like that. And identifying a true pain point usually helps further justify going all the way to completing a project. If what they're asking you about is not a huge pain point, then they're just kind of dreaming. They're just kind of wondering what could be different.
Right.
But by really pushing in, I can see how that would help bring a project further because they're more committed to seeing a resolve to what issues they're experiencing.
Yeah, it makes it real.
Yeah.
Keeping it real. It all goes back to keeping it real. You have to find out who the decision maker is, right? Like sometimes you think you know, and then you get the budget back and you find out, oh, it's actually the other partner in the relationship is the one who's pulling the strings or is making the decisions. And this whole time I've been addressing the wrong person. So that's a critical element at the beginning of a project. That's a whole other conference, probably a whole other podcast series right there is who's the decision maker, right?
Yeah. John, thank you.
Thank you. This has been nice. No, I was going to say, I really appreciate the time today. And this was a great experience. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
A solo architecture firm can be an extension of your personality. You can build a practice by serving your network. That network connects you to people they know, who then connects you to people they know, and on and on. It is the story of the classic backyard bird, a cardinal, showing its colors, and the word spreads through the neighborhood. Soon, everyone has sunflower seeds in their feeder to experience the vibrant colors from their home. That sounds so easy, but building a natural network of referrals doesn't always happen. Here are three key things that have strengthened John's professional practice and the network that he's built. First, live life. First and foremost, John dives into his life, the way he lives to connect with other humans, which comes from knowing how to live and enjoy life. Having hobbies and interests beyond architecture can be a way to connect with people who may need your services or know of someone who needs your services. But John doesn't just float around as a social butterfly, he's a cardinal. Cardinals follow a routine. If they found sunflower seeds in your feeder, they will check back in the next day to see if there are more. Similarly, when John connects with someone, he follows up intentionally, whether it was a small question that he can answer or just calling a contractor to see how things are going. This leads us to our next point. Be visible. Part of being a cardinal is getting out there and being seen, so you are top of mind. This can be a formal call to contractors, former colleagues, professional associates like engineers, or following up with former leaves that have just gone quiet. It could also be a simple call or lunch, coffee, a connection, something that can remind others who you are and what you do. If you miss the social side of working in a big office, this can be a way to bring that socialization back into your solo firm. Being visible can just happen naturally. It's how John shows up to life. It's how he connects with people. While doing school drop-offs, games, hiking, hobbies, or anything else, he's living life loud as the color red, putting himself out there to be seen. Our cardinals aren't super subtle about it, which leads to our final point. Stay curious. When John shows up to live his life and connect with people, he is asking questions. He isn't just talking at people. In this podcast, he called it being a good human. You can connect with others, ask questions, be curious, and then listen. Let the other person share their thoughts and concerns. Listen for the underlying problems to see if there are ways you can help or connect them with someone who can help them. This may seem perfectly obvious, and when these actions align with your natural strengths, this cardinal strategy can be an authentic way to market your solo practice. And so you can build an architectural practice like a cardinal. It may seem too obvious. It may not even seem like marketing. It's just a way to switch from that word marketing or selling your services to simply looking for problems that you can solve. One way to solve people's problems is to get out there, connect with them, and listen to how you can help. This is kind of old-fashioned business sense, and cardinals have a classic look to them. If these strengths align with your personality, you could also build a classic solo practice with your own Red J twist. This episode was brought to you in collaboration with Entree Architect, which is a fantastic community for finding like-minded entrepreneurs who are there to support you in your business journey. Please subscribe, share, and join the Flying Solo Movement community. We are just taking flight. Please join this journey for ongoing inspiration, support, and resources. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Katie Kengis. My hope is to encourage aspiring entrepreneurs and architects to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.